Good morning. How has daily life changed across the Middle East in what is now a regional war? NPR correspondents in four countries describe the new normals they see on Morning Edition from NPR News. One of the first strikes of the war hit an Iranian school and killed mostly children. I'm Leila Fadel in Erbil in the Kurdistan region of Iraq.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington. Early findings from the Pentagon say the United States is to blame. Also, the Trump administration wants to make it harder for immigrants with temporary legal status to be truckers. It's Thursday, March 12th. This day in 1804, Samuel Chase became the only Supreme Court justice to be impeached. He was accused in part of being partisan and was acquitted on all counts. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The war in Iran is stalling oil shipping in the Persian Gulf region. Six ships have been attacked in the past 2 days, according to a British maritime tracking service. That includes two oil tankers that have been hit in Iraqi territorial waters. This is the first oil-related strike on Iran's neighbor and ally, Iraq, in this war. Iraq now says it's halting operations at all its oil terminals. NPR's Gina Raff has more on the attacks.
A port official said the attack early Thursday targeted vessels in an area of Basra port. Iraqi officials said one person was killed in the strike, while 31 crew members were rescued. Iraq's security spokesman called it an act of sabotage. The ships were flagged in the Marshall Islands in Malta, but shipping records show one of the tankers owned by a New Jersey-based company. Iran has stepped up its attacks on oil installations and shipping in response to U.S. and Israeli strikes, saying the world should be ready for oil prices to double. Jane Araf, NPR News, Erbil, in the Kurdistan region of Iraq.
President Trump said last night that oil prices would come down because an international group is going to release some of its oil stockpile.
The International Energy Agency agreed to coordinate the release of a record 400 million barrels of oil from various national petroleum reserves around the world, which will substantially reduce the oil prices as we end this threat to America and this threat to the world.
But oil prices are not falling. The price of the benchmark Brent crude is near $100 a barrel. The motoring club AAA says U.S. gas prices climbed again overnight to an average of $3.60 per gallon. That's about 60 cents higher than before the war started 2 weeks ago. The U.N. Security Council is condemning Iran for launching missiles and drones at Gulf Arab nations. Russia and China argue that the council should also be criticizing the U.S. and Israel for launching the war, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Russia and China abstained, allowing the resolution drafted by Bahrain to pass. U.S. Ambassador Mike Waltz says it had a record number of co-sponsors, 135 countries, in a sign of just how united the world is against Iranian missile and drone strikes.
Iran's strategy of sowing chaos, of trying to hold their neighbors hostage, has clearly backfired, and that was shown by this vote today.
Russia's ambassador proposed a different text, but that one failed. Vasily Nebenzia says countries didn't muster enough strength to call out those who started this war, the U.S. and Israel. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, Dow futures are down 200 points. This is NPR. The Social Security Administration is investigating new allegations that a former staffer with President Trump's cost-cutting effort, DOGE, may have misused sensitive Social Security data. Separately, some members of Congress are also investigating a whistleblower's complaint. The Washington Post first reported that allegation. It says a former DOGE worker retained databases of personal information on nearly every living American. The Social Security Administration contradicted the claims of the whistleblower. The Justice Department has quietly restarted a program that allows some people with felony records or who are accused of certain felonies to regain their federal gun rights. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has more.
The 22 people the Justice Department approved to get their guns back lost their Second Amendment rights because of felony convictions decades ago. The DOJ maintains that the people on this list pose no public safety risk and had committed their felony crimes many years ago. That is, except for one, Arizona State Senator Jay Kaufman. He was indicted in an Arizona fake elector scheme from 2020. He received a pardon from Trump last year, but still faces those charges in Arizona. A DOJ official said Hoffman poses no risk to public safety. Hoffman didn't respond to NPR's request for comment. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
NASA says that one of its old satellites has safely crashed into the eastern Pacific Ocean, as was expected. The Van Allen Probe A had been exploring Earth's radiation belts. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
It was the summer of 1935, and tensions were high in Minneapolis. The city had just witnessed two major labor strikes, including the Teamster strike, in which police had clashed violently with picketers. And now, the city was staring down a third labor strike as the workers of the Strutwear Knitting Company voted to unionize. Most of Strutwear's workers were women and underpaid. Labor organizers called Strutwear a sweatshop. Strutwear claimed that outside agitators were whipping up discontent. Strutwear put pressure on Thomas Latimer, the mayor of Minneapolis, to quell the strike. As a major employer and taxpayer in the city, Strutwear threatened to leave Minnesota if Latimer didn't do something. Latimer sent the police to the factory to confront picketers. Minnesota's governor, Floyd B. Olson, stepped in on the side of the workers. He sent National Guard troops in to help workers keep the factory closed. The strike lasted for a year, and negotiations continued after that. By the end, all of the workers at Strutwear unionized.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Erbil in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, where Iran is making good on its vow to regionalize the war the U.S. and Israel started nearly 2 weeks ago. And it's having global consequences.
We're about to check in with four countries affected. We know the effects here in the United States, where Americans have noticed higher gas prices. Iranian officials are speaking directly to, quote, ordinary Americans on social media, saying this war is why they're feeling economic pain. They feel that pain because Iran is attacking its neighbors and leaving ships burning in the Persian Gulf. Iranian officials are also threatening to go after U.S. banks in the region after their national bank was struck.
We've got four of our international correspondents joining me now to talk about the uncertainty of this moment. Hadil El-Shalchi in Beirut, Aya Batraoui in Dubai, Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv, and Ruth Sherlock on the Turkish-Iranian border. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Leila.
Hadil, I want to start with you in Lebanon, because we saw overnight this intense bombardment again in the southern suburbs of Beirut. What is happening?
Right. So in the evening last night, Dahiyeh, which is in the southern suburbs of Beirut and considered a Hezbollah stronghold, got wide evacuation orders. And then the bombing started late last night. You know, and the Israeli military is killing Hezbollah operatives and members of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. But then Dahiyeh is also a residential. It's densely populated. So those strikes are also killing civilians, more than 600 people so far, according to officials. It's also not a fancy part of Beirut. It's not very rich. And the number of displaced is rising dramatically. Like last week, it was 400,000. Just a couple of days ago, it was 700,000. And then just yesterday, it jumped another 100,000 to 800,000 people.
Where are they going?
Well, the people with money are able to get hotels, some renting apartments, but like astronomical prices. And then the rest are on the streets. In West Beirut, on the beach, people are sleeping on sidewalks, under blankets, making little fires to keep themselves warm because it's, you know, still pretty cold here. I went to one shelter, Sports City Stadium, on the outskirts of Beirut. And I talked to Maysoon Mann. She had left Dahye on foot just like 3-4 days before she arrived at the shelter. She had slept on the streets. And now she sleeps in a tent with 6 other people, including her brother-in-law. This is what she told me.
So she's saying there she can't even wash for prayer. There's no place for her to be clean.
She said she hadn't showered in like 5 days because, you know, the stadium isn't equipped for people to live there. And there's also this suspicion now among Lebanese people. Like, for example, East Beirut, where I am, is a majority Christian, and nobody's taking the displaced here.
Yeah.
Just because they're really worried about, you know, being a target.
Completely a different scale, but here in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, it's kind of the same thing, and the concern is around foreigners. So it's been harder and harder for anybody to find a place to stay because they also don't want to be targeted by Iran, who is retaliating. And that brings me to you, Daniel. I mean, you're across the border of Lebanon and Israel. We've seen these devastating attacks in Lebanon, but there's also these rockets coming across the border and retaliatory attacks from Iran. What's it like there?
Well, last night was really dramatic along the northern border with Lebanon. Hezbollah mounted its largest attack of this war so far, more than 100 rockets fired overnight. Iran fired at the same time. There has been really, really high support for the war that Israel and the U.S. launched against Iran. But this morning, I am hearing a crisis of confidence in Israeli leadership, especially from Israelis in the north, very close to Lebanon. This frustration about this expanding war with Hezbollah and people saying, well, wait, didn't we fight a war with Hezbollah last year? These are people who fled their homes at the start of the Gaza war. You know, it's incredible to hear Hadil speak about these masses just on the streets and in stadiums. These are Israelis who came back to their homes, thought that they were rebuilding their lives, and now there's suddenly a new war. They're sleeping in shelters, in safe rooms, and people are asking themselves, well, wait a minute, is this a new normal? Are we going to be expecting war every few years now?
You're describing this, the starting cracks, right, among people. I mean, it's upending lives. What is the rhythm of life where you are in Tel Aviv after 2 weeks? It's almost 2 weeks of missile fire.
You know, it's really been surreal. I had not really fathomed in the many years that I've lived in this country just how many bomb shelters there are everywhere. You hear the air raid sirens, you hear the loud booms, you hear sometimes the really loud missile impacts. We've seen craters from where missiles have hit here in this city of Tel Aviv, this metropolitan city along the Mediterranean coast. There's no panic, but people are just really tired. We've had missiles fired throughout the night, so people are not sleeping, and that is compounded on this general sense of exhaustion after 2.5 years of war.
Actually, there's a very similar feeling here among Lebanese people who are leaving their homes, that they actually had a chance to rebuild because, you know, the war a couple of years ago with Hezbollah and Israel, they lost their homes, they lost their buildings, but then they were able to rebuild in the past 15 months or so. And now they say, I don't know if I can rebuild again. And so that's also causing a lot of anger here, too.
I'm listening to you and Daniel talk about this exhaustion of war and then trying to get back to life and rebuild. And this is where I want to bring you in, Aya, because this regional war now, not contained between the U.S., Israel, and Iran, is now seeping into places that we'd never expect. A place like Dubai, known for luxury and stability and safety. I mean, what is it like there?
Dubai was built around basically this idea that you could come here, flaunt your wealth, have a really good time. People come here literally to be bubbled off from the rest of the world, from wars, from sanctions, and from that kind of instability. So when we heard booms overhead, their air defenses here have been incredibly successful, but the trauma has been so deep for people because they're just not expecting this whatsoever. You know, there have been limited numbers of deaths in the UAE from debris, and almost all of those people killed have been migrant workers. For the millions of migrant workers in the Gulf, whether that's from South Asia or the Philippines, a lot of them are considered essential workers, essential laborers. They're the ones driving the trucks, getting the food from the ports to the grocery stores. You know, I heard Daniel talking about this, like these air raid sirens. So we don't have bunkers in Dubai. Again, Dubai wasn't built for war. And we don't have as much time when we do get these missile alerts because we're so close to Iran.
And just a reminder, the attacks that are coming in are the retaliatory attacks from Iran.
Exactly. A lot of retaliatory attacks from Iran. They're all retaliatory because there's U.S. troops in the Gulf, and because also Iran's whole, you know, message right now is that I'm going to disturb the entire region's economy. We haven't actually seen an attack on any physical banking infrastructure in the Gulf until now. But very early on in the war, there were these Amazon data centers that were hit here in the UAE as well as in Bahrain. And that did disrupt e-banking services for me and millions of people across the UAE, just being able to pay your bills online and connect that to your banking. So that does obviously raise concerns that it doesn't take a mass casualty event to disrupt life here.
Ruth, I want to bring you in here because we have been talking about the way the region is feeling this war. It's not contained in Iran, but you're along that border and you're talking to the people in the center of all of this, right? This all started with U.S. and Israeli strikes in Iran and then spread like wildfire through the region. Yeah. What are you hearing from people that are coming across that border?
I mean, growing amounts of terror at this conflict as the bombardments intensify across the country. And from Tehran, for example, just the other day, I spoke with this mother. She had baby twins and a six-year-old, and they'd fled their home in the middle of the night, kind of on a whim. They'd managed to stay most of the week. But she said that night, the bombardments lit the sky red, and it was just too frightening for the safety of her children. She said they grabbed what they could, they headed to the border. The journey to the border itself, we're hearing, is pretty terrifying. We've spoken to lots of people who've talked about airstrikes landing kind of close to the road as they tried to get out. We've seen people arrive at the border and just collapse in tears for what they've lived through in the past week and sort of relief at finally being safe. So, you know, this war is hitting government infrastructure, but we're hearing about many, many civilians killed in the conflict too.
What are they saying to you about this war itself, the fact that it's happening? Are you hearing support? Are you hearing anger? Like, what are you hearing from people? Because we don't have the polling like we heard from Daniel in Israel.
What's interesting about standing on this border, spending 10 days speaking to people coming out, is that these are regular people, right? And we are hearing very little support for the Iranian government. I think the protests in January was a turning point where people say to us now, look, we just can't imagine continuing life under that regime. So there was some cheering for this war. At the very beginning, we were seeing people kind of going to the balconies in Tehran and like almost clapping when the bombs fell. But I've noticed a real change in approach in the past week where, you know, as more and more infrastructure gets hit, they hit this oil depot when it rained black, oily rain over Tehran. People are continuing to say, you know, what's going to be left of Iran after this war? So we're just really hearing this dual reality for Iranians. Most of the people coming out on this border neither support the regime or the war against it.
That was Ruth Sherlock on the Turkish-Iranian border, Aya Batraoui in Dubai, Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv, and Hadil Al-Shalchi in Beirut. Thank you all for your reporting throughout all of this and all of the danger you're living through as well. So be safe.
Thanks, Leila.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
This is People Powered KAXC, where you get deep dives into the nature of northern Minnesota. And sometimes you get some advice.
As the season of fall is coming to a close, please consider not getting rid of all your leaves that have fallen in your yard. Leaves that litter our yards provide hiding spaces and insulation in the winter for insects and a host of small animals. Also in the spring, leaves start breaking down, releasing nitrogen and other nutrients back into the soil, making a natural fertilizer. This concludes the Phenology Report. Have a great week and be observant.
You can learn and stay curious by listening to the brand new Season Watch podcast featuring the voices of students across the region and Charlie Mitchell and John Latimer. Go to KEXC.org or Spotify or Apple to sign up for the Season Watch podcast.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Rolaids, containing a dual-active formula with the goal of neutralizing acid in seconds for heartburn relief. Rolaids spells relief. Learn more at Rolaids.com. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, investing in creative thinkers and problem solvers who help people, communities, and the planet flourish. More information is available at Hewlett.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The Trump administration is intensifying its crackdown on immigrant truckers. The White House wants tougher rules for commercial licenses after several high-profile crashes involving foreign-born drivers. Critics say that would force hundreds of thousands of legal immigrants to leave the industry without making the nation's roads any safer. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
Jorge Rivera has been driving a truck in the U.S. for more than a decade. So he was surprised when he went to renew his commercial driver's license last year in Utah, where he lives, and found out that he couldn't.
It was like a slap in the face because, man, like, I've done everything the right way. I've stayed out of trouble. I've been a law-abiding non-citizen is what I like to say.
Rivera was brought to the U.S. illegally from Mexico when he was 2. He's enrolled in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, better known as DACA. That allowed him to get a commercial driver's license in 2014 and start his own trucking company.
I even have my company name tattooed on my body.
Rivera pulled his truck over for a video interview and showed me the tattoo on his arm with his company's name and a freeway.
So can you really see the freeway, the mountains? The roads, I-15, it's Utah, Colorado, and Vegas. That's my route. That's what I do all year. You could tell me right now a mile marker on I-15 or I-70. You could tell me any mile marker in any state, and I could tell you what's there.
So if you can't drive, that's just going to totally cripple your business, right?
At this point, I'm just pretty much bracing for the worst.
Rivera is part of a lawsuit seeking to block proposed regulations from the Department of Transportation. The White House wants to make it harder for immigrants with temporary legal status to get commercial driver's licenses. During the State of the Union address last month, President Trump urged Congress to pass a law named after 7-year-old Delilah Coleman.
You are a great inspiration. Please stand up.
2 years ago, Coleman was severely injured when a tractor trailer slammed into her family's car in California. Homeland Security officials say an immigrant from India who crossed the southern border illegally was driving that truck.
That's why tonight I'm calling on Congress to pass what we will call the Delilah Law, barring any state from granting commercial driver's licenses to illegal aliens.
To be clear, states are already blocked from giving commercial driver's licenses to anyone in the U.S. illegally. Immigrants do need work authorization from the federal government in order to qualify for a CDL. But the Delilah Law, as well as regulations proposed by the DOT, would tighten those restrictions. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals put the brakes on the emergency version of those regulations last year. The DOT tried again, issuing a final rule that takes effect Monday. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says that's necessary because state DMVs can't evaluate the driving records of immigrants who have not been thoroughly vetted.
We don't go back and look at their driving record, so we have zero insight into the kind of people we're giving a commercial driver's license to. Unacceptable. So what we're going to do is increase the requirements for a foreigner to get a commercial driver's license.
But despite some high-profile incidents, the Trump administration's critics say there's no data that shows drivers born elsewhere are less safe than U.S. citizens.
There is absolutely no evidence to support that claim.
Wendy Liu is a lawyer at the nonprofit Public Citizen Litigation Group, where she's leading the legal challenge against the proposed regulations.
Everybody who gets a commercial driver's license has to pass all the same tests, has to do all the same training. Prohibiting them from having these licenses based on their immigration status just doesn't make any sense.
Liu says every fatal crash is a tragedy, but the right response is to get unsafe drivers off the road, regardless of where they were born. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Okay, the news can be stressful. Our personal lives can be, too, and it can be comforting to talk to someone about that. Sometimes, though, it's hard to find somebody to talk with.
All around us, we see people who are struggling, isolated, particularly coming out of the pandemic.
Cindy Cox Roman is with the nonprofit Help Age USA. It advocates for the rights, dignity, and well-being of older people, and during the lockdowns for COVID-19, she learned about a program in Zimbabwe called Friendship Bench. It trains older people who become known as grandparents to sit and listen to anybody who just needs to talk, sometimes on a bench, sometimes not.
What an amazing program that trains older people to be that safe space for people of all ages to share their story.
After reading how the program reduced symptoms of depression, Cox Roman partnered with Friendship Bench to adapt the program in 2024 here in Washington, D.C. Volunteer grandparents get 10 weeks of training, 10 weeks to learn how to listen. None of them are medical professionals, but Cox Roman says they have their own expertise.
As an older person, people have the life experience of having seen it all in a way. When you're younger, you're more judgmental. Think, why would someone do that? You get older and realize life happens to all of us.
Tuari Marshall is a retired teacher and a Friendship Bench volunteer.
It's about empowering the individual to solve their own issues. You know, close your mouth and open your ears and just to listen. Listen to what's said, listen to what's not said.
So true. Some of Marshall's visitors have come back multiple times, and even if they never return, they still get a check-in. Dr. Rebecca Brendel teaches psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and says follow-up matters.
Just a human connection can do quite a lot for the kinds of mental health symptoms that we experience as part of being human.
Last year, the American Psychological Association reported that nearly half of psychologists have no capacity for new clients. Brendel says that makes programs like Friendship Bench important.
The majority of people who are struggling with any kind of mental health symptom never access any kind of care. If we want to help people get access, bring it to where people are.
Cindy Cox Roman says her group's adaptation of the Friendship Bench method can now be found in community spaces in D.C., like schools and libraries, and the initial findings of an independent evaluation are promising.
100% of visitors would recommend it to someone else. Depression scores on the standardized questionnaires dropped for most people. Social connections were strengthened, and 90% of people said they now had someone to talk to about their mental health.
She says a program like Friendship Bench could work across the country. Listening to America, this is NPR News.
The U.S. has long tried to combat gender-based violence worldwide, but much of that came to an end with the Trump administration's slashing of foreign aid last year.
They never said violence against women was okay. It was just getting rid of anything that made a reference to gender.
I'm Elsa Chang, the ripple effects of aid cuts on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Pam Perry from Brainerd is a regular contributor to the KAXE morning show. She talks about birds and other wildlife. We asked her why she supports this station.
So, and now the most recent thing is the newsroom. And I love the news reports. You're not hearing that anywhere else. You're not hearing about what county boards are doing and local governments. This is the place. This is where you're going to hear about it. And the music was wonderful. You know, and you had your volunteer hosts. And again, local people often, I want to support it. I want to support something. And then, of course, when I was listening, I was going, where else do you hear about bud break and plants and birds and forestry and all the things that, you know, were Northern Minnesota?
You can become a member like Pam Perry. Give now at kaxc.org. You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 529. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks for listening to the Thursday morning show. Coming up in a few moments, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer will look back at his nature notes for this date, March 12th. Coming up at 6:20, Kari Headland talks with our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. Snow is likely this afternoon, highs today in the mid to upper 30s and variable gusty wind. Most areas either have a winter storm watch or warning in effect from 1 p.m. today until 1 p.m. on Friday. Snow accumulations ranging from 1 to 8 inches, winds up to 50 miles per hour. Our chance of precipitation continues overnight with lows 17 to 23 and blustery winds. For Friday, chance of flurries and blowing snow, partly sunny, highs 28 to 32, winds from the northwest up to 30 miles per hour. KAXC kicks off our 50th birthday celebration with the People Powered Pilsner. It's a collaboration with Clackow Brewing in Grand Rapids, Bemidji Brewing, and Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter. We're having a beer release party tomorrow evening, March 13th from 4 to 7 at Bemidji Brewing. Our DJs will be spinning records, and a portion of all Pilsner sales goes to KAXC. Join us as we say cheers to 50 years and many more. Actors Repertory Theater presents three viewings. It's a trio of one-act plays set in a funeral home, March 12th through the 21st at the Dryden Theater on the campus of Central Lakes College in Brainerd. Find showtimes and tickets at clcperformingarts.com. The Bemidji Senior Center is celebrating St. Patrick's Day a little early. Today, 1 to 3, they're having a dance. They are also selling raffle tickets for a gift basket. That drawing will take place during the dance. Thanks for choosing KAXC this morning. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, March 12th in the year 2000, I see my first northern harrier. It's a male. Smaller and silvery looking with that identifiable white rump. The white rump is present on both the male and the female. The female is larger and dark brown, but the males usually arrive first. And they come just as the snow clears the fields. So once the snow is off of the open fields, the northern harriers begin their return to northern Minnesota. As soon as they can work those fields and find those mice that they so enjoy, they will be back tracking, hovering, and attacking all of those field mice.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, a workplace food platform dedicated to making it easy for organizations to order food from a wide variety of restaurants, set up employee meal programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, investing in creative thinkers and problem solvers who help people, communities, and the planet flourish. More information is available at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Leila Fadil in Erbil in the Kurdistan region of Iraq. A preliminary assessment by the Pentagon has determined the U.S. is at fault for a missile strike on a school in Iran on the first day of the war. The attack killed at least 165 civilians, mostly children, according to Iranian officials.
We have a description of the U.S. investigation findings from a U.S. official who spoke on condition of anonymity because they're not authorized to speak publicly. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf is here. Kat, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
What is this investigation?
So now the Pentagon has opened what's called a 15-6 investigation to determine not if the U.S. did this, but how the mistake happened, and also confirm that it was indeed civilians who were killed. Mm. That's expected to take months. In a statement, the White House reiterated to NPR that the investigation is ongoing and, quote, the United States does not target civilians. But if this is all confirmed, Steve, it would make this one of the highest, if not the highest, number of civilians killed by the U.S. in a single incident in 35 years.
Granting that they're still investigating, how could this have happened?
Well, NPR was the first to report that the strike on the school was part of a larger precision strike on a compound of buildings and was likely the result of outdated intelligence. Our colleague Jeff Brumfield reported that a previous map of targets in Iran showed that the building housing the school was once part of an Iranian Revolutionary Guard naval base in the southern city of Manab. But somewhere between 2013 and 2016, the school was separated and walled off from that base, according to satellite imagery that we've reviewed.
It just makes you cringe to think about it. And then there's these videos which appear to show a Tomahawk missile hitting the compound. What do you learn from that?
Yeah, Iran also published images of parts of the missile it says struck the school. Those appear to have come from a Tomahawk as well. Tomahawks are U.S.-made missiles, and only a handful of countries, including the U.S., use them. A few days ago, President Trump suggested that Tomahawks are, quote, generic and may have come from Iran. That's not possible. Several munitions experts we talked to have said the U.S. is the only actor in this war using Tomahawk missiles.
Kent, what does it mean that last year sometime, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth made a cut, major cuts, to an office that was in charge of what they call civilian harm mitigation, trying to avoid civilian casualties?
Yeah, I mean, Steve, as you know, there have unfortunately been many other civilian casualty incidents in previous wars and administrations, and those are hopefully mistakes that the U.S. can learn from. A few years ago, Congress mandated an office in the Pentagon to do just that, but shortly after Hegseth took office, he cut it by about 90%. He also fired a lot of military lawyers. Here's what Ona Hathaway, a professor of international law at Yale Law School, told me.
At every level, civilian protection has been deprioritized. But a modern army has to fight according to the law, and the law requires that you protect civilians.
That same U.S. official who told us about the preliminary assessment also told NPR that now all of U.S. Central Command has only one staffer assigned to civilian casualty mitigation operations. We reached out to the Pentagon about this, but didn't get a response. And I want to be clear, Steve, we can't say that this strike was a direct result of these cuts. Civilians are, unfortunately, always the worst and most affected in modern war.
Yeah, and in recent wars, U.S. military officials felt that mitigating civilian casualties was an important part of the war, because there's an information war, a war for hearts and minds. You don't want to lose people's support. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It is not hard to find video of ships on fire in the Persian Gulf. Iran has effectively blocked the movement of 20% of the world's supply of oil, along with other kinds of cargo. It's not yet clear how the United States can respond. President Trump has said the U.S. Navy is prepared to escort commercial tankers through the Strait of Hormuz. An analyst elsewhere in today's program reminded us that the United States has done that before, but can it work now? NPR's Scott Newman looked into it. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, has the United States escorted any tankers so far?
Well, not yet, although U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright posted on X earlier this week that the first tanker had been escorted through the Strait of Hormuz. That message was quickly deleted, and the Trump administration later said the claim was incorrect. The post sent markets significantly higher, and no one in the White House has explained how it happened. Experts say it is still too early to begin such escort operations because the confined geography of the Persian Gulf would leave U.S. Navy vessels exposed to land-based threats from Iran. Hmm. The eastern side of the Gulf is flanked by Iran's coastline, and according to Michael Connell of the Center for Naval Analyses, that geography significantly limits the warning time available to respond to incoming drone and missile attacks. The Strait of Hormuz is only about 20 miles wide at its narrowest point.
And even further in the Gulf, when you're looking at places like Bahrain or UAE, you're only talking about 200 miles, a little over 200 miles.
And land attacks aren't the only thing ships have to worry about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's not like the Iranians have a really strong navy where they could send ships out there, but they can lay mines.
Yeah, during the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, Iran proved effective at using cheap, easily deployed sea mines. Most were simple contact or magnetic mines triggered by a ship's metal hull. Weapons of this type severely damaged a U.S. frigate in 1988. This week, the U.S. Central Command says it destroyed 16 Iranian mine-laying boats. But the experts I spoke with noted that these types of mines can be dropped from the stern of virtually any vessel. Iran also operates small submarines capable of laying mines. The U.S. does have at least three ships that are equipped with for mine sweeping in the Gulf region. If Iran lays mines, clearing them could take weeks.
Good to know the U.S. has minesweepers, but where does all of this leave commercial shippers who need to pass through the strait, not to mention the whole world economy that's dependent on them?
Right. Well, since fighting began, underwriters such as Lloyd's of London are already uneasy about the security situation in the Persian Gulf. It's not clear whether Iran has been laying any mines, but if it has, the added risk would further complicate the insurance outlook for tankers transiting the region. Matthew Koenig is the director of the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security at the Atlantic Council. He worked on Iran policy at the Pentagon during the Obama administration. Cranny thinks mines are a potential problem, but they're part of a bigger picture.
As long as Iran has drones and missiles and continues to fire them, I think many commercial shippers are going to think it's just too dangerous, even with an escort, to pass through the strait.
After a conflict is over, even a small number of mines in these waters could undermine confidence in a safe transit and cause more delays in shipping. And that kind of uncertainty could mean even higher prices at the gas pump.
Yeah, and useful to hear from you that a U.S. Navy escort might just be another target for a cheap Iranian drone. It's a challenge, isn't it?
It is.
NPR Scott Newman, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
This is NPR News.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this, Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations, we really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
It's 5:43. You're listening to KAXE and the Thursday Morning Show. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:20, Kari Hedlund talks with our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. And at 7:45, we'll check in with our reporter, Larissa Donovan, to see what projects she's been working on. There's either a winter storm watch or warning going in effect today at 1 o'clock until Friday at 1 o'clock. For Crow Wing, Cass, Aiken, Itasca, and St. Louis counties, that warning in Beltrami County during the same time frame. Accumulations ranging anywhere from 1 to 8 inches. Our winds could gust up to 50 miles per hour. That snow should be moving in this afternoon, 1 to 3 inches today with variable gusty wind, and then chance of snow continues tonight, an additional 3 to 7 inches with low 17 to 23, blustery northwest wind. Chance of flurries tomorrow and blowing snow, partly sunny, highs 28 to 32. You can tune in this Saturday morning at 9 for the Oscar Breakdown with Andrew DeZingle, Heather Johnson, and Julie Crabb talking about this year's Best Picture nominees and more. Also, we want to hear about your movie-going experiences. That is our question of the week. What's the first movie you saw in the theater? What are your favorite movie theater snacks? You can text in 218-326-1234. There's more ahead from Morning Edition here on People Powered KAXE.
NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from United States Postal Service, dedicated to putting reliability at the core of USPS Ground Advantage to help businesses operate smoothly. More at usps.com/groundadvantage. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. One of the most dangerous animals on a farm is one of the tiniest, the Lone Star Tick. A small bite can lead to alpha-gal syndrome, which can be especially hard on farmers in close contact with livestock every day. Harvest Public Media contributor Rebecca Smith explains why.
It's a bright, crisp morning on the Lovelake Iris Farm in northern Missouri. Owner Sharon Pennington is standing in the barn where she's raised countless orphan calves and nurse cows over the years. But now, for the first time, the barn sits empty.
One cow calved and she had too much milk, so I was milking her and around all that fluid and just wondering, why in the world am I going to pass out or die?
Pennington was repeatedly experiencing anaphylaxis, a severe full-body allergic reaction. And after months of fear and confusion, she was diagnosed in the summer of 2025 with alpha-gal, a potentially life-threatening allergic reaction to a sugar found in mammalian products, such as red meat and dairy, that comes from the bite of a Lone Star tick. But for her, these anaphylactic reactions weren't just from eating mammalian-based foods. They also occurred after handling her cattle and their bodily fluids.
I was thinking I need to make sure my will's lined out. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Doctors aren't sure if these severe reactions are due to alpha-gal syndrome or if the allergy is kicking the immune system into overdrive more generally.
There's not great data.
That's Dr. Scott Cummins. He's an allergist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and one of the leading alpha-gal researchers in the country.
Patients are saying one thing and giving us reports of symptoms and reactions.
Those symptoms can include full-body hives, trouble breathing, irritated eyes, and even heart issues. He says there are some options for treatment, including medication, but it can cost thousands of dollars a month. At the University of Nebraska, researcher Sean Cross just completed a first-of-its-kind survey of farmers and ranchers with alpha-gal. He says more than 200 farmers from 28 states responded, the majority from Missouri, Oklahoma, and Arkansas, where the Lone Star tick is common.
69% of the respondents said that they had to modify work tasks associated to farming and ranching due to the diagnosis.
And he says the preliminary results show that 78% reported that their diagnosis was causing them to feel distressed and worry about the productivity of their farm or ranch.
The idea of like a person shuttering down a farm that's been in their family for generations because of this new diagnosis, I can only imagine what that really does feel like.
Rancher Kelly Decker raises beef cattle and sheep in north central Oklahoma with her husband and says she really struggled when first diagnosed in 2019. She considers herself lucky because her reactions are manageable, as long as she doesn't eat red meat and is careful around their livestock. But she knows of producers with alpha-gal who've had to leave farming.
My heart breaks for the people who have had to deal with that and have had to go through losing part of their identity from this allergy.
Decker says when that happens, the already small community of livestock producers gets even smaller. So she wants to see livestock and farming groups bring more attention to alpha-gal so that producers can navigate this growing issue. For NPR News, I'm Rebecca Smith in Missouri.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
So I found KAXE when I was in college here in Bemidji. I actually can remember being at the stoplights at Dave's Pizza, just jumping radio stations, and it must have been, I want to say it was the Jayhawks, maybe Wilco was on the radio, and it floored me. As like, wait, how am I hearing this in Bemidji, in northern Minnesota? I thought I had to be in the Twin Cities to get this stuff.
Mark is a member of KAXE. We are people powered. The music that you hear is not chosen by the government or an algorithm or a corporation. It's chosen by your friends and neighbors. Over 70 hours a week is produced by local volunteers. Support the people of northern Minnesota and KAXE with your donation now. Go to KAXE.org.
Tariffs are in the pipeline.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot. Learn more about Snapshot at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Snapshot not available in California or from all agents. And by Bitwarden Password Manager, helping to extend spring cleaning to online security. Bitwarden is used to manage unique passwords and secure logins across all devices. Bitwarden.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishour, in for David Brancaccio. On top of everything, the trade war simmers on. Yesterday, the U.S. Trade Representative announced an investigation that could result in a whole new round of import taxes. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
The Trump administration is investigating more than a dozen countries, including China, Vietnam, India, and the European Union, using Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974. The U.S. Trade Representative's office will be looking into whether these countries are producing too much, flooding the U.S. with cheap products, and making it hard for American companies to compete. But unlike the tariffs struck down by the Supreme Court last month, Section 301 levies can't be imposed right away. First, there has to be an investigation, public comment period, and a hearing scheduled for May. The Trump administration wants the Section 301 tariffs to replace a temporary 10% import tax President Trump imposed last month, which is due to expire in July. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve is meeting this coming week to figure out what to do with interest rates in this country. Interest rates are how the Fed manages two problems in the economy, unemployment and inflation. And the tricky thing is, it cannot fight both at the same time. Higher interest rates fight inflation, but are bad for jobs. Lower interest rates are good for jobs, but bad for inflation. So it's got to pick. And the war in the Middle East is making that a whole lot harder to do. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that.
It's a pretty safe bet that the Fed is keeping an eye on the war in Iran and its effect on energy prices, says Menzi Chen, an economics professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
I think they will be eager to make sure that they show commitment to not let inflation get out of hand.
Chen says the Fed usually focuses on core inflation, which strips out energy prices since they can jump around month to month. But he says the Fed is also going to consider scenarios where the conflict drags on, keeping energy prices high for a while.
And if it's sustained, then that's going to feed into core prices eventually.
That's because the cost of energy can affect prices throughout the economy.
You think of something like airfares, which are in quote-unquote core inflation, but a really important piece of the cost structure for airlines is their fuel.
Claudia Somm is chief economist at New Century Advisors. Higher inflation could cause the Fed to eventually raise interest rates. But Somm says the Fed will also consider what could happen if energy costs rise so high that the economy slows down.
That's a scenario in which the Fed would be stepping in and potentially cutting rates, even though those energy prices are higher, because it's starting to create unemployment and, you know, wreck growth.
Somm says all the Fed can do at this point is gather as much data as it can and prepare for any of these outcomes. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The price of Brent crude is up at almost about $96 a barrel. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are all down in the 4 to 5 tenths percent range.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, committed to business buying solutions to empower leaders to streamline and focus on growth. Learn more about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. And by Barron's Investor Circle, offering stock picks, market insights, and access to the Barron's editors behind a century of reporting at Barron's.com/investorcircle.
This week we got inflation numbers for February. Grocery prices rose 0.4% that month. That was before the war drove up oil prices and threatened the global supply of fertilizer. There have been periodic calls to control prices at the supermarket, even proposals to cap prices. Economists in general do not like that. So let's get into it. David Ortega is a professor at Michigan State University. Good morning.
Good morning, Sabri.
Whether it is government-mandated control over prices or some sort of arrangement for grocers to reduce their own prices, economists are not usually thrilled with the idea of price controls, to put it mildly. Why is that?
Well, it's because you're really tampering with the market mechanism, and it can lead to unintended consequences, things like shortages and sort of misallocation of resources. So when you have prices that are capped below the market clearing levels, producers have less incentive to supply those goods. And so they may shift to some of the uncapped alternatives, so to speak. You also end up with quality issues. It's also a bit of a sort of blunt targeting. These caps don't distinguish between price increases from, say, things like corporate profiteering or shocks that have sort of affected the market. And so a cap really penalizes both of those equally.
Is there an argument for temporary price controls? You know, yes, you'll have negative consequences, but maybe it's worth it for people to get a break on food prices for like a short period of time.
So it's just a temporary band-aid that can actually end up doing a lot more harm than good. So I think in order to get food price inflation under control, we have to sort of address the root cause of the issue. You know, what's happening with supply chains and the shocks and input prices, and also looking at sort of the demand side. But, you know, right now we're in a sort of period where there's tremendous uncertainty, not just in the food industry, but in the economy more generally. And that uncertainty in and of itself can be inflationary because it increases transaction costs as companies try to stay on top of an ever-changing economic environment.
Are there specific things government can do when there's a shortage of something or a supply chain disruption? I mean, can they take specific actions to bring more or cheaper food or commodities in?
So I think, you know, the actions that help here are those that address the root cause. Investing in supply chain resilience and agricultural research and development, you know, these are investments that have to be made now because it takes years for them to pay off. And this is how we can keep productivity up in the agricultural and food sector that will ultimately keep prices, you know, from increasing like we saw a few years ago. We need the best science, the best technology to be able to meet current and future challenges.
Dr. David Ortega, professor in food economics and policy at Michigan State University. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Sabri.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It is a minute before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll have more ahead from Morning Edition and 620 our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. Snow is likely this afternoon with a winter storm watch or warning in effect for much of our area, starting at 1 o'clock today, going through 1 p.m. tomorrow. Our highs today in the mid to upper 30s and variable gusty winds. Wind speeds could reach 50 miles per hour. More news is next.
Good morning. Iran is still blocking a major